Access number 4630, Reel 2.
Colonel Thomas, Reel 2. You said earlier that you were yourself accommodated. You're undercover. But was this the case with everyone at Chang'e?
Yes, I think so. I think 90, a good 90% certainly were undercover. Perhaps some wasn't as accommodation was as good as others, but inevitably in a force like that, you know, you do get a lot of gypsies anyway. And it was absolutely incredible how sort of two or three soldiers would try and hive off and live jungly on their own. Well, of course, when the discipline and rank and everything was restored, I mean, one had to do something about this. So they were brought in and jolly well made to toe the line and fit in anyway. And it just meant doubling up on accommodation. So certainly up until the time that I left Chang'e, which was in the September, most of the people were undercover anyway. But it didn't matter an awful lot. I mean, provided you had some stall where you had your few possessions, I mean, you could sleep out or do what the hell you like, because we didn't see any Japanese except at the entry and exit posts.
How could the officers enforce discipline under such circumstances?
That's a good question, but they did, because I think that the British Tommy is a pretty logical sort of chap, and in the main, they could see that the only way that we were going to exist was by being an organized body. And by this time, of course, and I'm talking about after being in the bag 3 or 4 months anyway, there was a spirit. We got over the business of dejection and depression and shame and what have you, and we realized, I think, that if we were going to get anywhere at all, God knows, there didn't seem to be anywhere where we could get anyway, but at least that if we were going to go down or up, that it would have to be all together.
You just mentioned the feeling of dejection. Wasn't much in the way of mutual recrimination?
Oh, yes, tremendous. And I think perhaps that naturally soldiers turned against the officers. I mean, there was a great deal of blame being passed about. The buck was being passed. Inevitably, it fell on the officers in the end, of course, as being responsible for everything. And one has got to remember that there were a hell of a lot of troops there who must have been completely bewildered by being there anyway. I mean, some of the poor devils, the 18th Division, had been bombed in the harbour only the week before and had come from East Anglia and had never been overseas in their life, had been on a boat for 4 months and had been bombed in the harbour and managed to scramble off the boat and save their lives, go up country, fought a couple of days against the Japanese, completely overwhelmed, taken prisoner, and no future whatsoever. So, I mean, when you think of these kind of things that were built into these men, I mean, it's awfully difficult to expect them to behave as normal human beings immediately anyway, or even as soldiers. And they were bewildered, depressed, and dejected, and it took some time to restore confidence in them, because as far as they were concerned, the whole system had let them down from top to bottom, and they were bewildered.
Was there any tendency to blame people at home because of what had happened?
No, I don't think so. I think that came in retrospect afterwards. I mean, we've got some very huge guns in the front here. They turned the 15-inch guns, and it's well-known history now that the whole of our defences were seawards. They turned those things round, and they fired. God knows where they fired to or what damage they did. You could see the things going over in the last couple of days of the war. And you hear them almost flopping down in the swamps in Johor Bahru, probably doing absolutely nothing, but at least Somebody fired through them, and they cost a hell of a lot of money for that. No, I don't think there was any blame at home. We were beaten absolutely to a frazzle, beaten mainly, I think, because of the air superiority of the Japanese. And from my experience anyway, if you haven't got this, in the end, you'll be defeated anyway, because it was absolute murder. I mean, everything that came down was theirs, and everything that was up there was theirs. There was absolutely nothing that we got. And in the last week of the war, there was the absolute ridiculous situation of them putting up a balloon, of all things, in Johor Bahru. And I think everybody on this, certainly I could see the thing, and I'm positive everybody else on the island could see it, could see this thing, and see this Japanese commander up there observing and spotting the island, and everybody wanging away at it, firing every damn thing that we got at it and getting nowhere near it, and nothing in the air to go and shoot the damn thing down anyway. I mean, it was as ridiculous as that. And that was an indictment of the power that we were supposed to be in, 1942 anyway. No, I don't think there was any recrimination. I mean, home was a long, long way away. Britain was a long, long way away. And at that, I think once you get into that situation and you're put into the bag, you begin to worry about personal things.
You said that you only saw the Japanese rally in Changi, but weren't they taking roll calls to count the number of people there?
No, absolutely. They couldn't care less. They didn't care. They left the administration finally. When I left Singapore, the administration had been left entirely to the British. And, there was a wire, there was an area, and one could be pretty certain that, say, of I don't know how many thousand troops there were, that were within about 50 or 60, that they'd all be there for 24 hours of the day. Those that managed to get outside and wander around, some of them were shot, some of them got out and got back in again, and I think one or two even managed to get back up country and join in Force 136, which was still at large in northern Malaya. But by and large, the Japanese didn't care less about that, couldn't have cared less about numbers or the administration. They were far too busy getting on with the war and taming the local population and taking over local government and certainly getting all the booty and all the stuff back that they wanted for their war effort. We were left entirely to our own resources. They made one or two. They showed the flag once or twice. And, of course, they absolutely destroyed all our faith in our unity when one day all the Japanese guards were replaced by Sikh guards, our own ex-Indian Army soldiers and Singapore policemen. And this was very, very shattering.
Did any of these Sikhs stay loyal?
Oh, yes. Many more stayed loyal than joined the Japanese. But, of course, if you remember later, the Japanese worked on this and formed the National Army. But I don't know what went on afterwards. But immediately one can quite see how, these chaps were from Indian villages just the same as our chaps were from Cambridgeshire and Lincolnshire villages, and once they were worked on, I don't think it was awfully difficult to produce volunteers, because after 3.5 years of experience as a PW, I have a thing about collaborators, and I'm positive that they can be found anywhere, and that goes for the British as well as anybody else. And it's just one of those things of life, I'm afraid.
Did you come across instances of collaboration from the POWs who weren't Sikhs?
Oh, yes. Yes, later on in Korea. I mean, one could be absolutely certain that if a collaborator was required, that he was available and the Japanese would find him out. They were there amongst our own people.
We'll come on to the question of collaboration later, since it involves Korea. You said earlier they were busy subduing the local population. Did the local population resist then?
Oh, no, no, they weren't allowed to. They weren't allowed to, because the penalties were... The penalties were too high. I mean, they were shot on sight. I mean, it was instant obedience. I mean, I heard talk of working parties going into Singapore and saying they'd never seen people scared so much as the local population. The Japanese could drop anything down in the middle of the street and the people would walk around it. I mean, there was a complete reign of fear which went on with the local population. It must have been pretty dreadful. They'd got a pretty full book of people that I think that were active. They were Chinese in the main, I think, who were obviously active with China at that time, both Chiang Kai-shek and the communists. And they were the Japanese had got a pretty good record of these people, and they were definitely there to sort them out and anybody else who got in their way. They absolutely cowed the local population and really smartened them up.
You mentioned the Japanese and Sikh guards. Can you describe in a bit more detail what precautions the Japanese took to prevent people escaping from Changi?
I don't think they took any except the normal ones of the obvious exits and entrances with rifles and ammunition and shoot on sight. They took a calculated risk about this. I don't think there was any need for them to bother. I mean, if you were a European wandering around Singapore, I mean, you could have been a Swiss national. There were Europeans. There were lots of civilians who were retained for their job, I believe, at the start. So there were European people mooning around Singapore. But I don't think that anybody sort of thought about escaping at the start. I don't quite know where they would have gone to or where they could have got to, except up to Force 136. But had there been any large escapes organized, particularly at that stage, it's difficult to think that it would have lasted very long, because the Japanese would have been on it like a ton of bricks. Their security was very, very good, really. And they were pretty thick on the ground by this time.
How did the Sikh guards behave towards the POWs?
Badly, very badly indeed. I mean, they were obviously very ashamed of themselves, and the only way that they could, what shall I say, justify being there was to be really bloody-minded about it. And they were bloody-minded, and we didn't spare them anyway. There were loads of Urdu and Swahili, Urdu and Bengali speaking officers amongst our own. And of course, every time organized parties went through these exits, they let the odd word drop. But again, they had to be extremely careful, because the Sikhs were quite capable of shooting us on sight.
Did you see that happen?
No, no, no. I don't know whether they ever did it, but I mean, they had this power, and the Japanese wouldn't have cared less about it. So one had to be very careful. And in any case, I think there was a feeling that the chaps had been, you know, pushed into it at that stage, and that, all right, it was just one of those things, but eventually we'd get round to it. But for the moment, there was nothing we could do about it.
How long were you in Changi?
I was in Changi until September. That was from the February, August, I think it was, the end of August, September, I can't remember exactly. But I hadn't been very popular with my CO, whose name I was, whose list my name was on by this time, and he obviously put me on the list of the first people to leave. And we were the first. The excuse given was that lots of people were on the list because they were being sent to a cold climate, and that they'd been in the tropics for years more than the other people. Well, that could have been true, I don't know. But anyway, the day came, and I packed my little bag, and we were given orders to be at a certain place, and the Japanese sent transport in for us, which was absolutely incredible. And we duly arrived at Singapore Harbour, all those who were chosen. I've never seen such a sight in all my life. There must have been about 5,000 or 6,000 of us there, and we were herded up. And there was a little boat there which was called the Fukai Maru, and it was about 2,800, 3,000 tons. You've never seen a more dirty, scruffy-looking ship in all your life. And, well, it looked like a little sort of inter-island boat. God knows where we were going. No one knew where we were going. And they pushed, incredibly pushed, the whole lot of us onto this boat. And then the fun really began, because the whole of the Singapore government, our ex-government, I believe, were on the boat. Certainly Sir Shenton Thomas was there. I shall never forget him. And he decided that it was absolutely ridiculous, the whole thing. There was barely standing room, never mind about anything else, and we were due to be battened down below. The thing was absolutely loaded down already with cargo. It was a Japanese troop transport, so I suppose that's the way they transported their troops, and what they thought was good enough for them was good enough for us, except that I think that they multiplied their figures by 3. Anyway, Shenton Thomas decided that he was going to stand up and have nothing to do with it. He should have been a subject of diplomatic treatment, I think, even at that stage. But they weren't prepared to listen, the Japanese military. There was a captain, a Japanese army captain, in charge of the boat. And the Japanese are very good at this, of hiding out of the way and letting their junior people negotiate before they step in themselves, or where negotiation is going to be agin them, well, then they let the lesser orders deal with it. And, of course, the opposition gets nowhere. But anyway, he did, and a lot of people were marched off, and the rest of us were left on, and down below we went, and we were battened down, and we lay on the floor. There were all great huge platform bunks in this thing, and I suppose there must have been 2,000 or 3,000 of us. I don't know to this day, but anyway, you could barely lay down in the thing, and that was it. And eventually we set sail, and they had a guard of 4, if you please, at the top of the hatch, and they had the outside toilets, which were over the side of the ship, and you did your business on these things hanging perilously in this toilet, and went up and down this small hatchway. We got, in the morning, we got a little bit of rice. And then we had a little bit of rice again at 6 o'clock at night, and we lay in the bottom of this thing. People were getting very sick, and we didn't know where the hell we were going or what was going to happen next. And after 2 or 3 days, we finally fetched up in Camran Bay in Indochina, and they allowed us. Surprisingly, they're battling people with Japanese. They allowed us up on the deck, and people recognized various places. They'd been there, and we weren't very far from Saigon. And we stopped there for a day, and down below again we went, and they didn't seem to have any precautions at all. They weren't worried about anybody attacking the ships or anything at all. It was an absolute free passage. And we eventually finished up in Taiwan, Takao, Formosa. And they took off, quite a lot of people by this time. They had to, because things were getting terribly bad. I mean, people could hardly move around, and there was a lot of dysentery creeping in. And they shunted us down they kept us on the boat. Certain numbers of us, they implied, would have to stay. We stayed on the boat, and they employed us for the next two or three weeks to a month, I think it was, loading barges of steam coal, and then finally loading, so we became black as night with that, and when we'd finished with that, they took us to some other barges, and we had to load the red bauxite, which had come up, I believe, from Java or somewhere down there. But it was pretty obvious that the activities that were going on there, that they were getting out all the loot, and incredibly, a little incident that occurred. I'd got to know one or two chaps who were sleeping next to me, and there was a farmer from Somerset, a young lad, a farmer from Somerset, and everybody called him Farmer, and the Japanese must have noticed this, incredibly. They got hold of him one day and told him that he wouldn't be going down on the party, and that Shoku, an officer, would be required, and two others. So he asked me if I'd go along with him, so I said yes. So off we went in a little boat, and we went to the other side of the harbour. And there was the most incredible sight, with four beautiful prize bulls, which were deck cargo, which the Japanese had brought up from Java. And they were absolutely filthy from top to bottom, of course. They'd been allowed to do all their business on the deck. They were just tethered there. They were almost in as bad a state as we were, except that they were up in the fresh air. But it was pretty obvious that they were shunting these pedigree cattle back. So the four of us as farmers were asked to muck out these cows, and we were told that if we made a good job of it, we'd be permanent. That was fun, because we had to feed them during the day. It didn't take us very long to swill and muck them out, and we had the Japanese on that particular boat. I don't think they'd seen any British PWs. It was a Dutch pleasure ship, a very, very nice ship. We got one or two little extras there, but the one thing was they gave us the most marvelous soybean cake to feed these bulls with. And, of course, we had a jolly good tuck into it ourselves, both before and after giving it to the bulls. Whether it made any difference to them or not, I don't know. And another small incident there, just to show how incredulous it all was. We were down working on these coal barges, and there was a padre there. I didn't see him again after ever. But he said to me, would you like to take communion? So I said, what? And he said, would you like to take communion? He said, the Japanese sergeant has given me permission to hold a communion service on the work site. And I said, yes, I'd like to. So we went over, and he had a communion service. Incredibly, he got all the bits and pieces there. He got the wafer biscuits and wine, which was quite heady at the time, and I think perhaps a lot of people were there for that reason, rather more than sort of making their peace with their maker. But there you are. This is the kind of thing that went on, I mean, in the middle of all this. And eventually they battened us down again, and we set sail, and this was a different kettle of fish altogether. I think they must have been worried about submarines and what have you. We were in a very huge convoy, and every night at about 4:30, they slipped us to the back of the convoy and did all this zigzagging or anything, and we were under no illusion at all that if anybody was going to be bumped off, the first lot to be bumped off would be us. And when chaps were allowed up to the toilet, it was pretty obvious that we had no Red Cross markings or anything like that. But about four other ships in the convoy did. and Japanese soldiers were marching round and round the decks in their kimonos with a great big red cross at the back. And there were all the real Charlies who should have had this, i.e. us, stuck in this old thing at the back, ready to be chopped off. And that was the position we were in again the next morning, I believe, when submarines are most active. But it was a dreadful journey. We had the most tremendous dysentery outbreak, and it was terrible. We lost a lot of chaps. I don't know how many. They just buried them. They started off the first chap that was buried at sea. They had us all up on, or quite a lot of us up on deck, and they made a tremendous ceremony of it. And they had a white blanket and God knows what before they tossed this chap over the side. And there was a lay preacher chap there who they allowed to say a few words, but then they got to the stage that they couldn't be bothered with this. There were other more important things. We were getting near to Japan, and people were going down like flies. They were really worried, I think, about it, because it was pretty ghastly. And we were going to pull into Japan, and I think it was so bad that they decided, no, that we wouldn't go to Japan. And they swished us round to Fusan. And we stayed on the ship a couple of days. They brought in a lot of doctors and authorities, and they took scrapes and things from us. And we were in a very, very bad way indeed. But they took us out at Fusan. We didn't know where we were. They took us out at Fusan, and they made us strip off all our clothing and sit, thank God, on a nice afternoon at the end of the docks there, completely naked, when they went through every bit of our possessions, right from... We had to march away about 30 or 40 yards from every possession that we got, and they went through it with a fine tooth comb, went back and changed. And they marched us around Fusan, which was terrible. One of the most degrading things that I think I've ever suffered. We were marched round and round Japan, round and round Fusan, and they turned out all the local population, who just stared at us, made absolutely no demonstration at all. And I think at that moment a lot of us sort of got our pride restored again, because it was pretty obvious that the Koreans were, the Japanese had got them right down, cowed, absolutely. Didn't seem to be any moral fiber or anything left in them. The place was absolutely bare. There was nothing in the country, and it was pretty obvious that if this was a place which they'd occupied for some, I don't know how many years, quite a few years anyway, that what was going to happen further down south in the co-prosperity sphere was going to be very upsetting for the local inhabitants. And if this was what Japanese Empire was all about, well then it wasn't a very good sign for the future. But there was a lot more to come, of course, and we were put on a train. And incredibly, the Japanese, again, to show the locals, they produced picnic boxes with tasty little bits of fish and as good a meal, I think, as we'd had since we'd used our illegal rations or anything that we got earlier in Malaya. And there we were on a passenger train, hard seats, but quite comfortable, beautiful country, very lovely country. We travelled overnight, and then we didn't know until we arrived that the train had been split, and they'd managed at the earlier stage to get all the junior officers, very, very junior officers, and practically all the sick men and all the hods and sods soldiers, and all the motley gathering had been in our section, and that the Lancashire Regiment, the Loyal Regiment, and the CO, and the large majority of the senior officers were going to be sent to another camp. We were separated without knowing very much about this. Didn't realize that we were going to be. And, of course, we eventually arrived at a place called Jinsen in this trade.